attention to Brother Carl Parry as he speaks to us on the subject. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers, sisters and young people. There are some 20 years that have elapsed between Isaiah chapter 6 and Isaiah chapter 7. As far as the record is concerned, that bridge of 20 years is simply spanned by the word "and" in the first verse. "And it came to pass." This is indeed one feature of the chapters in which the prophecy of Isaiah is constructed. They are out of chronological sequence, but they are linked by thematic construction. "And it came to pass." And the record is melding and welding the two chapters together. There is a deliberate connection between 7 and 6, and it's this. See, in chapter 6 and verse 9, Yahweh had said to the prophet, "Go and tell this people." And so in chapter 7, verse 3, Yahweh said to Isaiah, "Go forth to meet Ahaz." If ever there was to be a classic example of a person whose heart would be closed, whose eyes would be closed, it was Ahaz, king of Judah. "Go forth and tell this people." And that's why, brethren and sisters, the language is used of chapter 7 and verse 13. "Behold, take a good look, open your eyes, a virgin shall conceive. Hear, O house of David," in verse 13. You see, it's the language of chapter 6. "They will hear but not understand, and see but not perceive." Here is the example of the tragic work that Isaiah had to be involved in, to speak of the truth, knowing that that word would be rejected by those who would hear the message. And indeed, brethren and sisters, if ever there was a contrast between the exalted king of chapter 6 and the king of Judah in chapter 7, here it is. There could never be such a worse king in the days of Isaiah as Ahaz, king of Judah. We haven't really time to speak about this man. His name means possessed. And from a child, a teenager, he was possessed of sin. He had a deliberate policy, a single and deliberate policy, to introduce immoral lust into Judah. And he did it with chilling success. Introducing into the nation the grossest, sensualist kind of religion, deliberately. In the end, he closed the doors of the temple, a fitting closure, because God could never, ever have a nation worshipped with a head like that. And yet, brethren and sisters, despite all his gross and sensual evil, God was to demonstrate to this king a degree of mercy that demonstrates the greatness of the God whom we worship. You see, in verse 1, "It came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it." It was a unique combination of two nations, sworn enemies in the past, who made an alliance, Damascus and Samaria, Syria and Ephraim. It's the only occasion in Scripture where these two mutual and hostile enemies ever made an alliance. And they did so in an attempt to wipe out Judah and to replace the line of David with their own king and puppet, Tabeel. The significant point of the verse is that they could not prevail against him. And there was a deliberate providential block of that invasion. Because the drama of chapter 7, brethren and sisters, is that whilst the invading forces was virtually ringing the city of Jerusalem, God put a stop to that invasion to give Ahaz a final opportunity, a last opportunity, to manifest some kind of trust in the goodness of God. So this chapter really is highly dramatic. And God was to give the king one final chance. You know, the mercy of God, brothers and sisters, is astounding, isn't it? We read of him that he is long-suffering. This chapter is evidence of that great mercy of a king in the line of David who had deliberately brought into this nation the grossest, evilest religion. And finally, later on, closed the doors of the temple. But God still gave him opportunity. An amazing thing. Now, in verse 2, it was told the house of David, saying, Syria is confederate with Ephraim. And his heart was moved, and the heart of his people, as the trees of the wood are moved with the wind. It was told the house of David. We know in verse 13... that the house of David, the royal palace, was corrupt. Apart from a few men, of course, like Hezekiah, the royal prince. Is it a small thing, says verse 13, to weary men, that you also weary my God? The house of David, the whole palace complex, apart from a few individuals, was corrupt to the core. And it was told the house of David. You can imagine the news sweeping through the palace of this invading army, this confederacy, this unique confederacy, ring the city, attempting to wipe the nation out. It was told the house of David. And the record says, his heart, so the house of David is likened to a single individual, as one man, his heart was moved in fear, as the wind going through the trees. That's an interesting expression. If you come back with me to 2 Samuel chapter 5, there was a time when the house of David was faced by a similar invasion. And once again, the royal line, so early established in the line of David, was threatened by invasion. David had just been anointed king, and the Philistines, taking advantage of this turn of events, swept down in an attempt to wipe David out, to destroy the house of David. But they spread themselves in verse 18 of 2 Samuel 5 in the valley of Rephaim, the valley of the giants. And there they were, the Philistine host, about to wipe out the fledgling state of Judah and the house of David. But it's a different king on the throne, isn't it? A different king. And David's response in verse 19 was to inquire of Yahweh. And we know what God did. Yes, go against them. And he went forth, broke out, destroyed them. But the Philistines are never quitters. They are the kind of men that even in the face of the holy ark of God will stand firm and quit themselves like men. In fact, Paul used that badge of courage in Corinthians. They were remarkably fierce, stubborn, resistant men. So they came again the second time. Verse 22. And they spread themselves in exactly the same place. And you know, I think if we'd have been there, we'd have thought, well, if God gave us the victory in the first place, well, surely we can assume that there'd be victory in the second. But David wasn't like that. Verse 23. But when David inquired of Yahweh, he said, Thou shalt not go up, but fetch a compass behind them and come upon them over against the mulberry trees. And let it be, when thou hearest the sound of a going in the tops of the mulberry trees, that then thou shalt bestir thyself, for then Yahweh shall go out before thee to smite the host of the Philistines. And David did so as Yahweh commanded him. So here he was, instructed to go behind them and to stand very patiently in the mulberry trees. As the Philistines realized that they had been encircled by David, and as they turned around to face him and to charge towards him, he had to stand exactly still. And the closer they got, they still had to stand still until almost they could see the whites of their eyes, and the wind came howling through the mulberry trees. And God said, when you hear that, bestir thyself. Now Rotherham translates that, act with decision. And that's exactly what David did. So when we come back to Isaiah chapter 7, and we learn that the house of David, the heart was moved as the wind in the trees. If only they could have appreciated that many, many, many years ago, the house of David was also ringed by the enemies. But the wind in the trees was a symbol in which God said, act decisively. That's the one thing Ahaz could not do. Act decisively. Sometimes, brothers and sisters, we need to do that, don't we? To act decisively. Sometimes we waver and we go back and forth and we procrastinate. A decision sometimes need to be made with decision, decisiveness. The decisiveness of faith. The house of David's heart was moving back and forth like the wind in the trees. If only they could know the history of the house of David. So, Yahweh sends Isaiah in verse 3. He doesn't go alone. In verse 3, go forth now to meet Ahaz, thou and Sheer-Jashub thy son. Now, that's an unusual thing, isn't it? As the prophet took his son in his hands and as they walked towards the king. But you see, the names of these people were significant. As we'll find out in our next study, the sons of Isaiah were sons of sign. They were symbolic sons. Their names were significant. Isaiah, of course, means the salvation of Yahweh. God was going to offer Ahaz salvation. And his son's name means the remnant shall return. Now, we're going to defer a consideration of the remnant until later on in our studies. But suffice it to say, the son's name, a remnant shall return, was a symbol of a small group of people in Judah who would turn to God. The word return doesn't necessarily have the idea of coming back again. It can also mean to turn, and generally is the word turn. Because the whole drama of conquest and invasion was to turn people to God. And that's why Isaiah and his son stood before the king. To turn that king's heart to God. You know, God works like that, brothers and sisters. All things work together for good, for those who love and fear him. And the combination of events in life frequently are designed to turn us and change us. Give us new perspectives and attitudes if we are in fact sensitive to the providence of God in our lives. Not everything is providential, of course, but the major things are. And at times God does that to turn us to him, to discipline us, to teach us, to educate us, to those whose senses are exercised thereby. And the meeting was deliberate. It wasn't just to meet Ahaz anywhere in Jerusalem. Look at verse 3. Look at the exactitude of the verse. It was at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. When we look at the overhead, we're going to try and reconstruct this particular situation. Here is the city of Jerusalem here. There was up here an upper pool. It was called the Gihon Fount. The reason why it was called Gihon, because Gihon is from a Hebrew word which means to burst forth. And the spring here, which was outside the city walls, was an intermittent spring that bubbled up and burst forth, and therefore was known as Gihon, or the Virgin's Fount. It was to be the very spot where the promise of a virgin conceiving was to be given. And we'll see the significance of that in a moment. It's a little difficult to reconstruct the pools from the Old Testament and from looking at Bible dictionaries. And having put all this together, I think this is probably the best solution. You see, in the days of Ahaz, there was a conduit, which was an external channel, which can still be seen today, that took the waters from the upper pool in Gihon and brought them along the outside of the wall into the pool here, the old pool. Now, as you can appreciate, that's a highly vulnerable situation. It's the only real water supply Jerusalem has, but it's exceedingly vulnerable. If it's an invading army, all it has to do really is to stop the water supply, prevent access, and you could starve and besiege the city very easily. That's why in the days of Hezekiah, Hezekiah took the channel of that water through an underground schism into the lower pool, which then finally drained out into the old pool. That seems to be the way it was done. Now the record says there was a highway. Here it is on the map here. This road that in fact was probably parallel with the actual channel itself. So it's highly specific. Look at it again. We had to meet at the end of the conduit. So here's the conduit that took the water through. We're going to meet at the end of that. In the highway of the fuller's field. So it's not just any field, but the fuller's field. So the record is asking us to examine a little closely the significance of all of these things. Well, let's look at the significance of all of this. Let's first look at the conduit here, the channel that took the water. I'd like you to come to Jeremiah chapter 30. It's an unusual word, this word conduit. It's a channel or a water course. And here in Jeremiah 30, it's translated in the most interesting way. Jeremiah 30 and verse 12 and 13. For thus saith Yahweh, thy bruise is incurable, thy wound is grievous. Here's a nation that is unable to be cured. It's almost like the nation of Judah under Ahaz, isn't it? Almost. Verse 13. There is none to plead thy cause, that thou mayest be bound up. Thou hast no healing medicines. Now the word medicines there is our word conduit. Rotherham translates it, thou hast no healing bandages. Not really medicines, bandages. So really, this strip through here was like a bandage around the city. That's what it is. And that's a very appropriate thing, because water is needed for life. No water, no life. No water, no healing. So it's like a great bandage that was designed to wrap around a city and to heal it. So God was offering Ahaz healing. Now the conduit took the water. In Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 6, we are told what the water represents. Isaiah 8 verse 6, for as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh that go softly and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son, now therefore behold the Lord bringeth up upon them the water of the river strong and mighty. So this water which bubbled up softly from the region here of Gihon, the waters of Shiloh which went softly, represented the message that the prophet was to give the king. The soft, small, spoken word, the waters of Shiloh. Shiloh means one sent. Isaiah was sent by God, go and speak to Ahaz. So the waters that went softly from Shiloh was Isaiah's message. We know, don't we, that the water of life represents the word of God. Softly, a gentle approach to this king. What about the fountain? The fountain of life, which the waters bubbled from. What does that represent? Well, let's come across to Jeremiah again. Jeremiah chapter 2. And verse 13. For my people have committed two evils. Says Jeremiah 2 and verse 13. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that could hold no water. So here, at the very source of the water supply, out of which came the word, that water supply, that fountain, was a symbol of God himself. The fountain of living waters. He is the source of everything. So by meeting in the highway of the fuller's field at the source of that water, deliberately the record was telling Ahaz to look to the source of all life. Isaiah was attempting to try and get Ahaz to ignore the idols and to look at the source of all life. The virgin's fount. Now it is significant, brothers and sisters, that when we come to Isaiah 36, a number of years later, the Assyrian arrived on the scene. And guess where Rabshakeh stood? Well, in Isaiah 36 and verse 2, the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. So many, many years later, the Assyrian king stood in exactly the same spot where the promise of the virgin was given to Ahaz. So there's a significance, isn't there, in all of this? And he had the audacity, as he stood on that spot, to say in verse 4, "What confidence is this wherein thou trustest?" And he was standing on the very spot where the promise of Emmanuel was given. What is this confidence wherein thou trustest? Because that place was a symbol of putting trust in God and in the salvation that he would achieve, something which Ahaz never ever comprehended. Do you know what God's answer was to that question? What confidence is this, as he stood on the very spot of that place? Well, in Isaiah chapter 37 and verse 3, Hezekiah prayed to God, "This day is a day of trouble, rebuke and blasphemy, for the children are come to the birth, and there is not strength to bring forth." Why should Hezekiah mention that? Why should he say that there is an attempt to bring to birth the nation, but there's no strength to bring it forth? Because he understood, brothers and sisters, unlike Ahaz, that the virgin's fount, which symbolized the giving of Messiah to the nation, the God with us, as we shall see, that he knew that there was a gestation occurring in Israel, but they needed the strength to be able to bring forth. He is alluding to the bringing forth of the virgin's fount. And when God answered the king, we won't turn to it, but in 2 Kings chapter 19 verse 21, God said to Hezekiah, "You tell that king, the virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn." Because that place represented God's power to produce the impossible and to be with men, power with us. So we come back to Isaiah chapter 7. The geography was deliberate. Ahaz, look at the source of the water. Ahaz, believe the message that's coming out. The waters of Shiloh that go softly. Ahaz, believe that the God that can supply water to give you life can also save you. And more so, the event was to take place in the highway of the fuller's field. Now, what's significant about that? Well, the highway is a theme of Isaiah's prophecy. In Isaiah 35, it's called the way of holiness. And we know the theme, don't we? It was Israel develops that theme early on. The way of the tree of life. The way of Yahweh. The highway was a symbol of the way of truth. And that's why he was met in that spot. Ahaz had gone to the right hand and to the left. But there's an opportunity now to stand in the way. But it was more than that. It was the way of the fuller's field. The fuller. the fuller would have used the water from the spring to wash clothes. That's what fullers did in those days. They took the clothes and they washed them, they trod them underfoot in the waters that came forth from this region. Now, why should the fuller's field be significant? Well, you see, back in Isaiah chapter 1, and we won't go into the context of chapter 1 except to say that I believe it refers to the same time of invasion as chapter 7. Isaiah has said in verse 16, "Wash you, make you clean, put away the evil of your doings before mine eyes, and cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Seek judgment, relieve the oppressed, judge the fatherless, plead for the widow. Come, let us reason together, saith Yahweh. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool." And as the prophet stood there, brethren and sisters, in the way of truth, and the fullers were there, washing their clothes and trampling them and making them clean, the record was telling Ahaz, "Ahaz, come, let's reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they can be as white as snow." That's an amazing, amazing promise. Perfidious and evil Ahaz, crimson, stained with blood as it were, could be made as white as snow if only he would change, repent. It was an exceedingly merciful and generous offer by God as he kept those armies outside those walls at bay for a few brief moments to change the man, wash you, make you clean. And they stood there. Let's come back to Isaiah chapter 7. So what's Isaiah to say? Well, he said in verse 7, "Take heed and be quiet." It's not quite as blunt as that in the Hebrew. The word "take heed" is the Hebrew word shamar, which means to be on guard. Be on guard. He was outside those walls, pacing up and down, doubtless inspecting the water supply and realizing how vulnerable he was. Up and down he was, up and down. And Isaiah's first words are, "Be on guard." Wasn't he doing that? But you see, there is another guard that needs to be kept. Don't worry about guarding the city. God will do that. I'm talking about your life. Take heed to yourself. That's a very interesting theme to follow through scriptures. Take heed, be on guard to yourself. The heart needs to be guarded. The mind needs to be guarded. What goes in and out the mind affects us. Be on guard. Be alert. Be aware. Don't worry about the city. Worry about your life. And he said in verse 4, "Be quiet." Rotherham says, "Keep thyself calm." You can imagine this man pacing up and down, nervously, nervously, all the time. Keep thyself calm. It's profitless to worry if you can trust in God. There's a great lesson in that, brethren and sisters. Sometimes we become agitated and about things that seem to be going wrong, and we can't find a solution to a particular issue that's worrying us. We pace back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, in the end, often, God resolves the issue for us. Keep thyself calm. As Isaiah said in chapter 30 and verse 15, "In quietness and confidence shall be your strength." Sometimes we waste a lot of nervous energy worrying and worrying and worrying. In the end, a simple trust in God often resolves the problem. Keep calm, I guess. Keep calm. "Fear not, neither be faint-hearted, for the two tails of these smoking firebrands." You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that sometimes when we view problems, they loom very large. As Ahaz viewed on the horizon this amalgamation of two strong armies, ring the city. God says, "Look, don't worry about them. They're just the ends of two smoking firebrands, often when you view the problem from God's perspective, it's not really a problem. They're just like the ends of two torches just about to fizz out. But to Ahaz, the problem loomed enormously large. It's a great lesson that too, isn't there? Sometimes we need to take a step back from this insoluble problem and see it from God's perspective. And it sometimes and often is totally different from our perspective and our perception. But Isaiah was being very careful in the words he was using. See, those two words there, fear not, neither be faint-hearted, are drawn from the law. Let's come back to Deuteronomy chapter 20. Fear not, neither be faint-hearted. It's the law which deals with invasion and war. In verse 1, when thou goest out to battle, be not afraid of them, for Yahweh thy God is with thee. Verse 2, it shall be when you are come nigh to the battle that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people and shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, ye approach this day into battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint, fear not, and do not tremble, neither be terrified because of them. Those words, faint and fear not, are the same words that were used by Isaiah the prophet. Now, what is the significance of this piece of legislation? Why were they not to fear? Verse 4. Yahweh your God is he that goeth with you. God is with you. Emmanuel, God with us, was about to be given. To fight and to Isaiah to save you. And that's why Isaiah used those two words from this context. Because there's a context in which God is trying to say to Ahaz, listen, God is with you to save you, if you can trust in him. But did you notice that it was the priest that was to say those words? And that was Ahaz's problem. There was no priest. As he marched up and down those city walls looking at the watercourse, because he had no trust in God. Now when we come back to Isaiah chapter 7, you imagine the king being confronted by the prophet with his young son. Don't worry. Don't worry. In verse 7, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, it shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass. This confederacy will not stand. It was a clear, precise, unequivocal point. It won't stand. And here's the challenge in verse 9. At the end of the verse, the prophet said, If ye will not believe, surely ye shall not be established. Now there's a play on words in this verse. See, the word believe and the word be established come from the same Hebrew root. And it could be translated like this. If you will not support yourself, that is on God, you will not be supported. Or if you will not hold firm, you will not be made firm. There's a play on words in those two particular Hebrew words. If we put it in the positive, it reads like this. If you have faith, you will be established. And that's why we have here at the top of our overhead that expression placed in the positive. If you can believe, you'll be established. Now that's an important principle that God is outlining, not only to Ahaz, but to us. See, the protection which God was about to give and offer this people was conditional upon their response of faith. If you can believe, you will be established. It's like the law that said to one of the men in Matthew chapter 9, according to your faith, be it unto you. The measure of faith that can be expressed is in direct proportion to the amount of assistance God will give. The stronger the faith, the fuller the healing those people experienced. According to your faith, let it be unto you. It's a great expression, brothers and sisters, that we need to understand. That if we can believe and have that full confidence in God, God will establish us. Doesn't mean to say that life will be rosy, there won't be any problems, but God will establish us. Now those words, again, were drawn out of an important context. In 2 Chronicles chapter 20, if Ahaz had any sense of history, those words should have been ringing in his ears from the recent past. Because in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, we have the identical circumstances which Ahaz was experiencing. A huge confederacy of nations had come across the border and were threatening to wipe out the house of Judah and Jehoshaphat. We learn in 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 3 that Jehoshaphat feared. He was afraid, just like the house of David was. But this was the difference. He set himself to seek Yahweh. Verse 4, to ask help of Yahweh. To seek Yahweh. There's a difference. And an amazing prayer of faith. He approached his God, and God answered his prayer. Leave the battle to me, he said. The battle's mine, it's not yours. And the next day, the armies of Judah went out with the Levites and the singers in front. Ever thought of sending out warriors, unarmed, singing the songs of God? That's faith. That is faith, brothers and sisters. And in verse 20 of 2 Chronicles chapter 20, they rose early in the morning and went forth into the wilderness of Tekoa. And as they went forth, Jehoshaphat stood and said, hear me, O Judah. Believe in Yahweh your God, and you shall be established. Those are the words that Isaiah picked up. Only Ahaz could believe that. Only he could understand that if we can have faith and trust in God, to send out, as it were, the musicians before the enemy, we will be established. Remarkable, isn't it? Now, we come back to Isaiah 7. And you can imagine the prophet labouring these points through, speaking them, asking Ahaz to settle down and to redirect his energies and to put his trust in God and to be established and to explain to him that these problems that you see, they're just like smoking firebrands. They will soon disappear. Don't worry. Believe, Ahaz. And the appeal of the prophet was strong. Look, if you can believe, you can be established. If you can't believe, then you won't be established. Ahaz, do you understand what I'm saying? And look at verse 10. Moreover, Yahweh spake again to Ahaz. What does that mean? It meant, brothers and sisters, that there was not one ounce of response from this king. There was no acknowledgement. There was no answer. There was nothing. So that God again had to prompt Isaiah to continue the discourse. What an amazingly evil man. Given every opportunity, and he was absolutely silent. As the silence progressed and progressed, verse 10, moreover, Yahweh spake again to Ahaz. God broke the silence. There was nothing from him. How tragic it is when we make appeals to others and there is not one ounce of response. There was nothing from this man. And so God again encourages him. Verse 11, ask thee a sign of Yahweh thy God. That's a very generous statement. Yahweh was not Ahaz's God. But he could be. He could be. Ask thee a sign of Yahweh thy God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height. God was still going to give him one final opportunity of appreciating the power and deliverance of God. In the depth or in the height. Ask for some tangible token, some evidence to prove the presence of God. If you doubt that God exists, Ahaz, look, we'll give you evidence. Anything you like, anything. To the deepest, to the highest, anything, Ahaz, to convince you. And the response of the king was an emphatic no. Verse 12, I will not ask. You know, it wasn't, well, look, could I think about it, or look, let me consult with some people. It was, I will not ask. He could not bring himself around to accept the existence of God and thereby bind himself to some obligation of worship. And man is so much like that. Given every opportunity, but they know that as soon as they say yes, there are obligations involved and they don't want them. And under the pretext of a religious guise, I cannot tempt Yahweh. He was quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 16, but he failed to finish the quote which said, tempt not Yahweh as ye tempted him in Massah, which was the occasion when they said, is Yahweh amongst us or not? Ahaz didn't believe that at all. And so God says, listen, O house of David, in verse 13. The house of David, almost as though Ahaz is pushed aside, and the royal house is now addressed. Is it a small thing, says verse 13, to weary men? Will you not also weary my God? Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. The Lord himself. There is a very personal thing about this. Himself. God is going to be intimately involved in the salvation of men and women. Himself. I'm going to give you a sign. I'm going to bring the heights and the depths together. A virgin shall conceive and bear a son. And they shall call his name Power with Us. Not Power with You, or Power with Ahaz, or Power with the House of David, Power with Us. And we'll see the significance of the us in later studies. I'm not going to tell you in this study who I think Emmanuel is. I'm going to defer that to our next study, keep you in suspense. But there was definitely an application of this prophecy to the days of Ahaz, because in verse 15 and 16, butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings. So the child that was to be born was some identity that before the child could reach maturity, or even the youthfulness of knowing right and wrong, that God would remove both kings, and he did. So there was an identity which was known to the people of Israel as Emmanuel. We'll find out about that in our next study, God willing. But in the ultimate sense, it's of course the prediction of the birth of Jesus Christ. Or should I really say, the conception of Jesus Christ? Because the Hebrew is not so much a virgin shall conceive. The Hebrew is a virgin being with child. And there's a difference there, isn't there? The Authorized Version emphasizes conception, but the Hebrew is emphasizing being with child, as though the father is suppressed from the verse. Because we know, don't we, that God was the father of Jesus Christ. The virgin was being with child. It was a miraculous situation. And it was power with us. The tragedy of this incident, after all that expression of mercy, is found for us in our final quotation, 2 Chronicles and chapter 26. Sorry, 2 Chronicles chapter 28. The king in this chapter, Ahaz, was the king in verse 3 who burnt his children in the fire. He's a father who destroys his children. So different to the God of Isaiah 7 who gives birth. And in verse 5, because of his evil, Yahweh his God delivered him into the hand of the king of Syria. And God released those forces. He'd been keeping them back, pending the possible responsiveness of Ahaz to faith. And because he refused, they smote him. And carried away a great multitude of them captives, brought them to Damascus. And he also was delivered unto the hand of the king of Israel, who smote him with a great slaughter. For Pekah, the son of Remaliah, slew in Judah 120,000 in one day, which were all valiant men, because they had forsaken Yahweh, Elohim of their fathers. Zichri, a mighty man of Ephraim, slew Maaseiah, the king's son, as Hezekiah's brother. And Azrakam, the high priest. And verse 8, they carried away captive 200,000 people. The faithless decision of one king, the refusal of the mercy and long-suffering of God, resulted in that day of the death of 120,000 men, the death of his own son, and the removal of 200,000 men, women and children to captivity. If you cannot believe, he will not be established. But if we can believe, and we can trust in our God, we shall be established.